This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. And before I introduce today's guest, I'd like to continue on a little bit about this issue of how we know what we know. We've talked about logical fallacies a little bit briefly in the past, and I think there's some confusion about science and the scientific method that I want to clarify, which is also a very powerful way of thinking about and trying to figure out how the natural world works. Physics, biology, and science are just studies of matter and life and biological structures and chemistry. They're not really what science is. Science is really a method of observation and explanation through experimentation of what we see. And I think that seems confusing when it's really very common. It was about in the 17th century that people like Francis Bacon and Galileo began to formulate which has been a way of testing the environment in the natural world that has become formulated very succinctly as the scientific method. But it's something we do, if you think about it, every day, traveling to work or cooking a creme brulee, for example. If you just want to make a suggestion to yourself and make an observation that, boy, maybe this is a different way to go to work or a different way to cook a creme brulee based on some of your observations, then you go ahead and do that. You travel in a different way or you make that creme brulee in a different mechanism. And if it turns out better or you get to work quicker, then you've tested that hypothesis and come to a conclusion. When you really get down and look at it harder, it may be that it worked better under a certain set of conditions. Perhaps you got to work better and faster one day because the snow was there or the school was not in session. And the same with cooking, which are what we call confounding variables. But it's really not that unorganized. It's not that difficult of a concept. And I thought it worth talking about briefly because it's the basis of much of what's going on in medicine today. And a lot of what we're going to talk about with Dr. Epley, our guest, is known because of testing. And certainly he started his interest in vestibular disorders because he noticed that there were problems in making these diagnoses and getting patients treated. My guest today is Dr. John Epley. He's an internationally known specialist in particularly vestibular disorders. He started the Portland Otologic Clinic in 1975, and he soon and shortly after that, as I've already alluded to, noted that there's been a lot. He had problems or saw people that were disabled with these vestibular disorders and didn't seem to know how to address that. The patients didn't know how, and he's kind of dedicated his career to research and treatment of these disorders. Dr. Epley, it's a great pleasure to have you join us on Line One.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the basic beginnings. Again, I like to define things and get to some definitions out of the way. But let's talk about what we mean by the vestibular system to start with.
Well, the vestibular system is what we use to number one, keep our balance, and number two, when we move our head about, it keeps our eyes stabilized so that things don't blur. Without the vestibular system, every time we turned our head a little bit, things would blur. But the vestibular system organizes everything for us and keeps us oriented to the world, which way is up and which way is straight and so on.
And where is that system located?
Well, it doesn't have an exact location. For instance, the eyes have a system in the back of the head. The visual cortex and the ears and hearing have a cortex, the auditory cortex, in the temporal area. But there's no actual area such as that in the brain. Actually, the brainstem has some nuclei and so on that handles a lot of it, but it's more or less handled throughout the brain and doesn't have a particular area.
But the vestibular system, what I was getting at is, as you define it, is located as part and parcel of what's going on in the middle ear or the inner ear?
Yes, the inner ear controls it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gives signals to the brain, and the brain sort of puts all that information together and makes sense out of it. But it all begins in the inner ear. There are actually two portions of the inner ear that are involved. Number one is the otolith organ, which is a little organ that has crystals on top of it. And as you tilt your head and so on, the crystals give signals to the brain that the head is tilted so many degrees and so on. And also, there are the semicircular canals, which give signals to the brain about moving the head to left and right or up and down. What we call angular movements or rotatory movements, they give signals to the brain, and that controls the eyes so that your eyes are more or less stabilized. And if those semicircular canals are altered in some way, if there's something that affects them, then you can have a sensation of spinning.
So the mechanism, I just want to kind of decipher out or look at this system a little bit more. There's actually kind of a fluid, I think of it as called endolymph, that's moving in these semicircular canals and around this otolith organ that are then propagating signals that are interpreted back through the auditory nerve or nervous system back to the brain, and then it interacts with inputs coming from the eyes and from our sensation, our feet, and where we are, the other things that tell us where we are in space. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And the eyes are more or less dominant, but of course there are times you can't use your eyes in the dark or when other things are moving in the background and so on that you don't have anything to key on. You have to depend on your balance system. And then our somatosensory system with our feet and so on, feeling pressure of the ground, or we're sitting in a chair, up, we can tell up from down. It's interesting. We've learned a lot from the astronauts. When they go up into space, they have no gravity at all, and without that gravity, they're very disoriented for a few days. And then maybe they're up there for a few weeks and get pretty disoriented without the a feeling of gravity. They come back to Earth and they have that feeling of gravity, and it takes sometimes a week or two for them to readjust to having gravity.
Mm. So the effects of these organs are modified by even having gravity around, and so that's why once you get into a weightless situation, the normal function or the typical function of these this system is awry or out of the ordinary for a while. Is that the reason then that the astronauts might have some problems?
Yes. Well, without the gravitation, they have no way of telling which way is up or down. Everything is just neutral, and so they can actually be upside down. They can't tell the difference.
Mm-hmm. So even with a functional otolith organ, which I think of as helping us determine where gravity is or acceleration, I think as you've implied, that still won't work necessarily, or at least it takes a while to adapt in a weightless situation?
Yeah, well, you have to use your eyes entirely to mm-hmm. judge where up or down is. Of course, if you're inside a spaceship, what was originally the floor is more or less what is down now, although right. You might look out the window and see that the Earth is up above, out the window above you, so-called above.
So your frame of reference is extremely confusing. All right. And what kind of symptoms would you begin to have then, did those patients? You said disoriented. The astronauts, did they get nauseated as well?
Yes. They typically get very nauseated and sick for the first 24 to 48 hours. Of course, the older ones, those that have been up before and have been conditioned and so on, they handle this better. But it's a very unnatural situation. We just sort of take it for granted that that gravity is there and it's going to take care of us and pull us down. And without us, we become very nauseated at first, but they can adjust to that.
Are there other common symptoms of vestibular disorders we should discuss?
Well, the most common one is what we call dizziness, which could be a feeling of disorientation, a feeling of things moving or spinning. Sometimes you just have a feeling in your gut. We call it giddiness, where you just don't feel right and you feel sick. Actually, this happens when the different organs that are telling us which way is up and down and so on don't agree with each other. If our ears tell us one thing, say we're on a ship, and the ship is tilting to the side and so on, and our ears tell us the ship is tilting to the side, but we look over to the wall, and the wall is still straight up and down, so that information doesn't agree. And it's this disagreement between the information that that causes the nausea. Or, for instance, with astronauts and no gravity, it's there's no information there.
Mm-hmm. Is a ringing or buzzing sound in the ears often associated with vestibular disorders?
Sometimes with Meniere's disease, it's typically made up of three symptoms. There's the ringing in the ears. There may be temporary hearing loss at first in episodes, and then gradually losing the hearing, usually just in one ear. And then the dizzy episodes, the spinning, the feeling that the whole room is spinning like you're on a merry-go-round.
Okay. I'm going to take a short break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to Line 1, and then we have a caller that I think wants to ask a question about Meniere's disease, and I want to go ahead and take her note. So those of you who are listening, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. John Epley. He's a specialist in vestibular disorders. He's joining us by telephone from his office in Portland, Oregon. So if you've got calls or questions or comments, you can give us a call at 550-8433, 550-8433. And then if you're outside of Anchorage, toll-free 1-888-353-5752. And those of you who listen frequently know you can also email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at KSKA.org. And we'll be here between 2 and 3 Anchorage time, and you can listen later this evening at a rebroadcast or at any time by going to KSKA.org and go to the link Line 1, and you can hear these podcasts that have been saved for listening at your own leisure. Leslie, you're on Line 1. What can we do for you?
Oh, hi, Dr. Woodard. I've been listening to you for years. Thank you for your show. And thank you, Dr. Epley, for taking my question. It's about Meniere's disease. My husband was diagnosed with Meniere's by hearing tests only after his first attack 4 years ago. He also had thyroiditis attacks yearly for over a decade, but he stopped eating gluten 4 years ago, was negative on celiac blood tests, but has both predisposing genes for celiacs. He went then an unprecedented 4 years without thyroiditis or Meniere's attacks until this year when he had a mild form of both, with only fullness and hearing loss in one ear. He was traveling and eating some wheat at that time. Do you think that he has autoimmune-induced Meniere's disease responsive to gluten restriction? What other triggers would you look for? And triggers in general, what workups do you do?
Well, we're not sure of such things as gluten and allergies and so on. Meniere's disease is still a big question as far as what causes it. there seems to be a trigger initially that sets it off in at least one ear, maybe a virus, maybe trauma. Most of the time we don't know what it is, and then the person begins to have attacks of vertigo and ringing and so on. And then after a period of years, it may move over to the other side.
What's the pathology that we know? Do we know what goes wrong in the vestibular system that causes the symptoms, Dr. Epley?
Well, we know what goes wrong. We've known that for years. And the main thing is the increase in endolymphatic fluid pressure. And the fluid in the inner ear builds up pressure. And then there's a release, perhaps. There's a rupture of the membranes that are holding it in place. The pressure builds up to the point that there's this rupture, and when that occurs, there's a spinning episodes, and then the fluid in the inner ear intermixes with other fluid that it's not supposed to mix with, and that produces a toxic situation in the ear that clears with time, but with repeat episodes, why this can damage the ear severely and also damages the balance system on that side.
What about Leslie's husband's observation that he's got these episodes of what appear to be autoimmune phenomenon, and, you know, it seems that, you know, his symptoms improve, the symptoms of Meniere's disease improve when he's off gluten and not. Is there a mechanism with which that might happen, or what's your experiences with autoimmune phenomenon in Meniere's?
There's no question that there's often an autoimmune aspect to this, and that's particularly shown by the fact that you can give corticosteroids by mouth, and it's fairly effective. However, you don't want to give big doses of corticosteroids over a period of time, you start to get adverse symptoms from that.
Right.
In recent years, there's been a big move toward giving the corticosteroids transtympanically or intratympanically, which means you put it behind the eardrum. We make a small opening in the eardrum and put in the corticosteroid solution, and this is absorbed through the round window into the inner ear. It's much more effective that way. It's hard to get it into the inner ear when you take it orally, so you have to take a pretty big dose, and that affects the rest of your body. But there's a real advantage to giving it intratympanically and directly into the ear. It absorbs then. We place it into the middle ear, which is the space behind the eardrum, and the round window is right there. It's a very thin membrane that connects directly into the inner ear. And there's no question that Meniere's disease can be very much controlled by this in most cases, except the very bad cases. So there's a autoimmune aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And then we see sort of a sympathetic effect. It's similar to the effect you see in the eye. If an eye gets damaged, say someone's punched in the eye or something, and the eye deteriorates on one side, in time it will go over and start to affect the other side because there's an autoimmune effect built up in the original damaged ear. And this seems to be what happens with Meniere's disease.
Mm-hmm.
One ear is damaged and constant disease in that ear produces an autoimmune effect, and the body begins to reject the involved ear, but the autoimmune system is not able to tell the difference between the right and left ear, so eventually that can affect the opposite ear as well.
Leslie, in your husband's situation, it seems that you've noticed a at least an association between avoiding gluten and it reoccurring in symptoms. Has symptoms of thyroiditis or Meniere's disease ever happened when he was doing fairly well at avoiding gluten?
No, he had complete absence for 4 years, and then and then probably got some incidental wheat. The House Ear Institute Clinic in California has done quite a bit of research on both food sensitivity connections and viral connections. So I was kind of curious about trying to root out the actual trigger instead of just treating the symptoms.
Yeah. Does he have any of the more classic symptoms of celiac disease or gluten enteropathy involving the intestinal tract?
No, he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be unusual to have gluten as a trigger. Although there can be many triggers, and many times these triggers are foods and so on, which suggest that perhaps that condition that is caused by the trigger is actually something else. May not be a typical Meniere's disease with pressure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People will, right after a meal or after drinking certain drinks, particularly wine and beer and so on, and we think it's actually not the alcohol, but it's the impurities in those drinks. Some people will develop a real spinning episode right afterwards.
Well, in this last episode, he didn't have any of the dizziness and vertigo that he had the preceding time, except for just one mild case of dizziness. He only had the fullness and then the loss of hearing, and that loss of hearing has pretty much come back so that his general loss in the right ear is 30% right now. So it's not classic Meniere's either. Is it worth what testing should he still have?
Yeah, I guess my thought here, and I want Dr. Epley to comment as well, is whether or not you really are dealing with Meniere's disease. If it doesn't quite fit it, maybe there is a neuritis going on, some kind of autoimmune phenomenon like multiple sclerosis and so forth, which I'm not saying that's what it is, but those are autoimmune disorders that do affect nerves in particular, and maybe that's more of what's going on rather than true Meniere's. But Dr. Epley, your comments.
Well, that's possible. I think it's important that the Meniere's disease be ruled out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What we call endolymphatic hydrops, which means that the endolymphatic system increases the amount of fluid and it builds up a pressure in there. That should definitely be ruled out, and it should be considered for treatment with such things as corticosteroids. There's a drug that has been very effective worldwide. Unfortunately, it's generally not available in the United States, and that's betahistine, B-E-T-A-H-I-S-T-I-N-E. This is a drug that increases the blood flow through the inner ear. At least that's the way we think it works, but it helps very much in keeping the pressure down in the middle ear.
Mm-hmm.
And this drug can be obtained through compounding pharmacies in most cities, but not generally. It's not generally available in every drugstore. It's a special drug in foreign countries. This is in Canada. Most of my patients just order it from Canada because they can get it through the mail. It's cheaper, and it's available in every other country except the United States.
Yeah, Leslie, I think I usually listen to the questions patients ask. I think what you're looking for is there some other trigger or something else to avoid? And I'm always thinking, what's the risk and benefit of treatments? And certainly, avoidance of gluten could be compatible with a very, very long life. And if it seems to be clearly whatever is going on is triggered by that, it's reasonable to suggest avoiding that. But Dr. Epley saying also, are we really sure that's what we're dealing with? And be aware of the possibility that maybe there's something else going on or a different approach that needs to be taken.
Yeah. And so as a last
question, and then I'll take the answer off the air, what kind of doctor should he see for complete diagnosis of Meniere's?
Good.
Well, I would say that a otolaryngologist, an ENT doctor, or a doctor that just specializes in ear, an otologist or a neuro-otologist would be the number one to see, because it's 95%+ of these are in the inner ear. And if you're dealing with the ear, you should have a doctor who knows how to deal with the ear.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for your call, Leslie. We have another caller that we'll go ahead and take these questions. Liz, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, thank you very much. Yet another wonderfully informative show. I thank you. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
just patting ourselves on the back end. So.
Oh, good. You should. I have some comments that kind of fold into the last statement that your last caller had. I have a history of having dealt with something called BPPV.
Right.
Which, if I get that right, is benign paroxysmal positional vertigo.
Right.
And this is a vestibular disorder that my first and worst, I should say, episode was 8 years ago. And I woke up one morning, sat up out of bed, and the vertigo was so severe that it was as if somebody had taken the house and tilted it back and forth very rapidly. I had to try and get balance by putting my hand on the wall, and pretty much stumbled around for a while, which was pretty bad at the time, because I had a newborn infant that I had to pick up and carry. My first comment is about getting a diagnosis of this. It was problematic here in Alaska, and I'm not sure if that was just 8 years ago. This disorder maybe wasn't known very well or what, but I knew eventually what to look for, what it was, through a brother-in-law who's a neurologist. He said, you need to find a doctor that can treat you, knowing that it's this BPPV. So I went to a neurologist in Anchorage, and I don't believe he really knew what what I was talking about, and then was referred to an ENT who sort of knew what I was talking about but didn't give me a treatment that would work. And then finally, through talking to a friend saying, oh, I've got this horrible problem, you know, I'm getting sick from this vertigo, and, you know, I'm worried about picking up the baby, they said, well, I know somebody who had that and had it treated by another ENT in town, Dr. Mamakunian.
Mm-hmm.
And I did go to see him, and he did something wonderful called an Epley maneuver, remarkably. wonder where that came from. And that helped my symptoms, and since that time, 8 years ago, I've had maybe once a year I've had another bout of it, but it's never been as severe. And I'm wondering, that's one of my questions, I'm wondering if once you know what you're dealing with, if your body somehow reacts or responds in a way to minimize the effect of having these little crystals in your canals that are making the world spin.
Okay. All right, Dr. Epley, why don't you tell us about benign paroxysmal positional vertigo?
Yes. Well, one thing about BPPV is that usually the first episode is the worst. You don't know just why that is, but typically you're sleeping and wake up and get up either in the morning or to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and end up on the floor after a few seconds. One thing that confuses people is there's this latency period between the time you get up or lie down or make the movement that causes the dizziness, and therefore it's hard to associate it exactly with that movement. But it's caused by the little particles that are in the wrong place in the ear. These particles are there when you're born, and you have to have them, and they serve a function, but they're in the otolith organ, the little organ that serves the sense of balance. But they break loose for some reason, from trauma or aging or certain ear diseases. Meniere's disease tends to cause this to happen as well. And they get loose and go into the semicircular canals where they're not supposed to be. And then when you go settle down in the semicircular canals at the bottom, because they're very heavy, and then you turn your head a little bit or lean over or lie down or whatever, and these particles shift, and when they shift, they move the fluids, and actually it's the movement of the fluids in the semicircular canals that gives you the sensation of turning. So this gives you a false sensation of turning. The maneuvers are very effective in most cases. Occasionally they are less effective, and I've been working for years to develop more effective ways of treating this. This is called benign paroxysmal positional vertigo because it is benign. It doesn't cause any worse disease in the ear. All it can do is cause you to be more and more dizzy if you don't have anything done about it. And it'll typically get better and worse over a period of time, maybe every month or two, or sometimes several months. It'll have a period when it starts getting worse, and then it may go away on its own, or it may not. Sometimes I've known patients that have had it for years and years, and it's just a constant bother to them. It can be completely incapacitating. And one of the things that is sort of a fallacy about BPPV is everybody thinks, well, it happens only when you lie down or get up or whatever, and there are forms of it that become so severe that a person can hardly turn their head or tilt their head a little bit. They have to remain completely still. And I've seen some cases like that, but if we know what it is and we identify exactly where it is, there are three canals in each ear. It can be in either any of the three canals on each side, so that's six places, and also it can either be in a loose formation where it's loose particles that are floating around, or sometimes these particles are on the little sensor in the semicircular canal. It's called the cupula. And they cause the cupula to be more heavy, so you put your head in certain positions, you start to spin, and with that you just keep on spinning, whereas if they're loose, you just have a spinning just as long as they are falling down to the lower portion when you turn your head or tilt your head in a certain way.
Is Liz's experience of a neurologist and apparently another ear, nose, and throat specialist not as familiar with this disorder uncommon in your experience?
Yes. Of course, this was developed in the ear area, and so otolaryngologists were much more aware of it sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And neurologists became aware of it quite a bit later on. And a lot of it was because there was nobody knew how to take care of it, didn't know anything could be done for it. So usually we more or less retain what we learned in medical school or in our training period, and anything that comes along later, we have to be informed through the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And this probably wasn't done so much in the neurological field.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more, all physicians are beginning to be aware of it now.
And how did you stumble on these maneuvers, and why do they work? I'm envisioning something that's loose and in these semicircular canals that are causing abnormal stimulation of the nervous system. And so that leads to the question in my mind, why don't we just take that thing out that's moving around, and then how do the maneuvers work, if you don't mind me being so naive about this one?
Well, it would be nice if we can take it out, but the inner ear is very delicate.
Mm-hmm.
Go in there and operate. Actually, there's an operation where we go in. We used to do this quite a bit more, but now that we have maneuvers, we are able to take care of almost all of them. And particularly with what we've developed recently, we can take care of all of it. But surgery would damage and destroy the ear. You can go in enough to do what we call a plugging of the canal. And most of these particles are in what's called the posterior canal. And it's the lowest of the three canals in each ear. because it's in the Loew's canal, the particles tend to fall to the bottom, and that's where most of them are. But to operate on that canal is very delicate. You can go in and put in a plug without damaging the hearing frequently, but to go beyond that and try to get the little particles out is almost impossible.
Okay. All right. Liz, other questions?
Yeah, one last question. Again, to what might be a precipitating event. I know you mentioned trauma as one. I wasn't an instance where there was head trauma that caused this initially. And my observation has been that when it's recurred, it's almost always happened in the winter. And I think I could also say that it also coincidentally has occurred when I have felt dehydrated, particularly dehydrated. I was just wondering if you had any evidence that that might be a precipitating cause.
No, I haven't, but that's interesting, and we should put that down as one possibility that we should look into. I haven't necessarily seen that being a case, but I have had people tell me that it happens more in the wintertime and things like that. It will typically happen at times when you're more sedentary, when you're doing more sleeping. You lie in one position. For instance, we were concerned. There's an article that came out in the literature a number of years ago that said, well, this is all due to alcohol because this doctor would tend to see a number of patients on Sunday morning after they'd been out drinking on Saturday night. What we finally found out, or we were able to work out, was that it wasn't due to that. It was not the drinking of the alcohol, but when you sleep after alcohol, you tend to just lie there in one position, not move for maybe 6 to 8 hours at a time, so that then when you get up on Sunday afternoon, then you have the spinning.
You're also...
It's pretty much after surgery, particularly heart surgery, where the person has to lie in one position for a long period of time. So perhaps the winter time, you tend to sleep late and so on, maybe that would make a difference.
Except for the first instance where I was nursing a baby, the alcohol and the sleeping might possibly be something I should consider, but the first time for sure, I know that those probably weren't causes. But I think the lesson is I'll try not to hibernate here during the winter.
Well, and stay hydrated. I mean, alcohol is, when you overdrink too much, you are dehydrated relatively because alcohol is a diuretic.
Absolutely. All right.
Throw that in there for as an observation. Thanks
very
for your
good.
Call.
Thank you very much, both of you.
What is the major difference? Just listening to you talk about, as a pediatrician, this is... new territory for me, Meniere's disease and this benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. What are the primary differences in history and of this particular disorder? Since we know what's happening in one and not in the other, I just kind of want to clarify in my mind what's the difference between the two in symptoms primarily.
Well, with BPPV, you typically have these. Well, the dizzy spells usually occur first when you get up or lie down or tilt your head. I remember I first had my first episode when I leaned over to get something out of a drawer. I leaned forward to get something out of the drawer, and I stood back up, and I practically fell back over backwards. And so it's a positional vertigo. It's most of the time set off by position, and we're in position change when you get in, get your head tilted and so on, as compared to Meniere's disease, which is not at all positional, but just comes on spontaneously out of blue or after eating too much salt or some meal that sets it off. Sometimes they are more common in relation to women's menstrual periods, so there may be a hormonal effect there, but it's Meniere's disease is completely unrelated to position.
Okay.
So that's the big difference between the two.
Okay. have another caller. Bob, you're on line one.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. October of 2006, had a problem that sounds a lot like your previous caller, and I was taking a phone call and then bent over to pick up a book or something, walked into the next room to talk to my wife, and all of a sudden the room just started spinning, and my eyes would just go from left to right very fast and then go back and forth, and I couldn't stop it unless I shut my eyes. And the next thing I got was nauseous and not knowing, having a clue as to what it was. We called emergency, and they hauled me into emergency in the ambulance, and at some point they gave me some Dramamine, but then it all died down. And after it was over, when I talked to the doctor about it, he said, well, it sounds like a one-time event where a piece of otolith breaks loose, and it might be age-related. At that time, I was 70 years old. And it's never happened again. I just kind of wondered, what's the likelihood that it would happen again?
Well, it may have been BPPV. It may have been something else going on. But the fact that you leaned over and so on, it very likely was BPPV due to the particles. And there is a fairly good likelihood if we have an attack of it that it'll happen again, particularly in older age. Interestingly, somebody did only been two studies in old folks' homes where they've just gone in and tested everybody, and they found at any particular time that people over the age of, say, 65 or 70 will have about 10% of those people will have BPPV at that time, at the time they test them. And even more so if you just consider those people over a period of time in their lifetime, I would say that between 40% and 50% of people will have BPPV at least once in their life, if not more often. I myself have had four or five episodes of it. And my neighbors and my relatives and everybody I know, it just seems that it's very common. And it's amazing that here was something that went so many years and didn't even realize what it was. A lot of doctors were never even trained about that such a condition existed, and yet it occurs in perhaps 50% of people sometime during their lifetime.
I see. Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Bob.
Sure.
You know, what the question comes to my mind is this disorder may have been in the past confused with simple syncope, which often happens, particularly even in young adults and teenagers, when they stand rapidly from laying down or sitting down and stand up quickly. They don't usually have true vertigo. They pass out, but that could easily get confused. And that's another issue that might happen in the elderly is the syncopal episode. So is that a confounding or confusing diagnosis sometimes?
Yes, that has to fit to the differential. And the main question that I usually ask then is, well, what happened when you're dizzy?
Mm-hmm.
Were you conscious and able to grab hold of something? Even though you weren't able to control yourself, were you conscious all during the time? Whereas with syncope, the person loses consciousness or partially loses consciousness, and it's a completely different feeling.
Okie doke. We still got a couple more calls. Let's keep answering those. Sherry, you're on line one.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Since 1976, I developed an abrupt tinnitus in my right ear, and that's been continuous since then. And I've essentially lost all the hearing in that ear. I have had episodes of vertigo and was diagnosed with BPPV many years ago. And I've also had many tests to rule out an acoustic neuroma, and those have always been negative. But a few years ago, I started having a couple of different kind of episodes where it wasn't necessarily positional, and they lasted a bit longer, and I got extremely nauseated, and what stopped the episode was retching. And somebody suggested that was a vagal response of some kind. So I had gone back to see the ENT who had originally diagnosed the BPPV, and he suggested that it might be a kind of atypical Meniere's and wanted me to take a medication whose name escapes me at the moment that is prescribed for altitude sickness, but just to start taking it and take it for the rest of my life. And I was reluctant to do that. I've made dietary changes and, you know, reduced my sodium intake, and but I still am having occasional episodes of what is the positional stuff, not the other. So I'm just curious about how that...
Yes, you can have both BPPV and Meniere's type symptoms at the same time, the same diseases. Now, BPPV in itself, having the particles loose in there, does not affect your hearing. Now, I understood, did you say that you lost your hearing in one ear?
Essentially, yes. The audiologists call it a useless ear at this point. It was a gradual, what started as a high frequency and just moved down, loss.
Yes, that sounds like Meniere's disease, and it will do that unless it's treated. And that's why you should, if you have symptoms like that, anybody who has symptoms like that should get it treated right away and continue to treat it, or they can lose their hearing, and then over a period of time it also can move to the other ear.
I've had a few. I'm having now a little bit of tinnitus in my other ear periodically, so...
Well, I'd be very aware of that. First of all, you can use your discretion about diet. Avoid things that are very salty. Avoid caffeine and so on. That can help a lot. But, of course, if you start to really have problems with ringing and loss of hearing and any dizziness that might be the other ear, then you should start treatment of that right away.
So it would be important for me to have that other ear checked out and hearing that? And
yes, and
okay.
Watch it over a period of time. I would say at least every 6 months you should have a hearing test to make sure that there's no deterioration going on.
Okay. And is it important that I see an ENT who is familiar with balance disorders, or...
Well, that's a good question. Many ENTs are not particularly interested, and they're working a lot in other areas. Ear, nose, and throat involves an awful lot, and some take an interest in one thing and one in another. There are ENT doctors that are, and what's called neurotologists, which are ear doctors that are more involved with dizziness, but they take more of an interest, and so they know a lot more about it. And a lot of the information that's come through has just been in recent years, so many of the older doctors are not very well educated.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they take a special interest in it. So you should find a doctor who has a special interest and special practice more in the dizziness area.
Okay. Is there an online list of, you're saying neurotologist? Is that right?
Yeah, neurootologist, right.
Neurootologist. Is there like a society of neurootologists, or?
Well, there is a American Neurotology Society, and I think the number of doctors in the United States that actually limit their practice to neurotology are down in just a few hundred.
Okay.
Usually within a city, you'll find four or five in a medium city. I'm not sure about Alaska, but usually you'll find just a general ear, nose, and throat doctor who takes a real interest in this area and becomes very good at it and should be able to handle it very well.
And, Sherry, although I'm familiar with the ear, nose, and throat specialist, I don't know the answer to your question, so I can't help you. I don't personally know anyone that's specifically. That doesn't mean there is not one, but I'm not aware of it. Okay, let's go to another caller. Nicole, you're on line one.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 7-year-old daughter who was diagnosed with an inner ear hearing loss when she was 4 years old. It is severe in the left ear and mild in the right ear. And though she was diagnosed with the loss, we have no diagnosis for why she has the loss. We've done an MRI, and the development seems normal, and we've been told that it's probably at the cellular level. And we also don't know if it was from birth or if the loss occurred during her early years. But her level of loss has been stable since we learned about it, since 4 years of age. And her speech and verbal skills are excellent. She's adapted beautifully, and you would never know she has a hearing loss, even when she doesn't wear her hearing aids. The other issue that we deal with is that she also experiences migraines, and she has done so from a very early age. We didn't know what was going on, but we've seen a pediatric neurologist, and we're told that she was actually showing signs of migraines from the time that she was anyway 4 months old, if not younger, on. And so my question is, in your experience, have you learned or heard that these two things could be connected? And if so, is there any information I can go to find out more about this? Or do you have any other suggestions for what we should do to learn more about these two problems and whether or not they're connected and what we might be able to do about them?
Well, this is an area which in which we don't know very much.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship between migraine and ear disease is even questionable, you know, in adults. There is a relationship, and very often I feel that most of the cases I've seen, the migraine is sort of secondary to the ear problem. And it may be that she's actually having Meniere's-type conditions in the involved ear that is setting off the migraine. But usually the migraine is secondary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I did a lot of research on Meniere's disease when she was first diagnosed, and my understanding is that there's often, you know, an ongoing hearing loss with the Meniere's episodes. And the one thing that's not really occurring for her is that so far her hearing loss has been stable. She does experience considerable vertigo, or can experience considerable levels of vertigo when she's experiencing a migraine. But the good news is we haven't had a migraine in 10 months, so I'm just feeling very hopeful. We've been following a diet that is written up in a book called Heal Your Headache by a neurologist at Johns Hopkins University. And while diet is not her only trigger for migraines, it certainly seems to be a part of the issue for her. And we're just, you know, watching it closely and doing everything we can. But if you have any suggestions for information that might be out there, or if I too should go and, you know, look up a neuro-otologist, if that's what it's called, that would be helpful for me to know.
Well, for the migraine, probably a childhood a child neurologist,
mm-hmm,
would be the best, and or other than that, a regular neurologist would know more about migraine. Mm-hmm. However, this is an area that is new. Our understanding of this is very poor, and I would say that it's important to consider that possibly it's the ear that is setting off the migraine. Some trigger is affecting the ear, and then maybe the migraine is secondary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I'm sorry I couldn't give you more information on that, but there's very little information, good information in the literature.
Okay. Appreciate your honesty.
Sure. Yep.
All right. Thanks very much.
The whole issue of hearing loss is a difficult one, is my understanding, being a pediatrician. Oftentimes, parents often expect a precise diagnosis, but often we can't find it. There's been a lot coming out about genes and hearing loss, and then there's always this issue of viral infections that happen during pregnancy that cause their damage. But long later, we have the problem, so it's hard to make the connection between them. You have any other comments about that?
Well, that's true. There are many causes of congenital hearing loss where they're actually born with hearing loss, and it can be either one ear or both ears, but and very often that's familial. Mm-hmm. We have family members all the way through. Sometimes it's just certain family members, but you can't have congenital hearing loss, and then I agree that many times this are infections that are developed during childhood. Mumps is well known to cause some hearing loss, and there are other viral diseases that the child could have during childhood. The main thing is to really check it out to make sure that there isn't an ongoing condition such as Meniere's disease that could be controlled, rather than to let that through the years have its effect and make the hearing worse. Last caller said that the child's hearing was stable, and that's a good sign that it isn't mm-hmm. ongoing disease. However, sometimes with Meniere's disease, you can have just the dizziness or just the attacks, and so many times that type of thing can trigger the migraines.
Okay. We have just about a minute left. I think I'd like to ask you just to sum up what you think are important bits of information to leave with our listeners today, Dr. Epley.
Well, I think that the main thing is with BPPV, you don't have to worry about it damaging the ears, but with Meniere's disease, it can damage the ears, and Meniere's disease is controllable. By far the most, I would say that maybe 5% of cases are not controllable with one thing or another, whether it's diet or medications placed in the ear or surgery. Very rarely do you have to go as far as surgery, but it's important to treat Meniere's disease. And with BPPV, of course, the treatment is very simple. In most cases, and where it's complicated, we have ways of taking care of it. I've developed this chair that is now available in a number of clinics across the country that can help in those cases of BPPV where the maneuvers don't work.
Thanks very much. I very much appreciate your taking the time to be with us today, Dr. Epley.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next week, Line 1 will be back, and we'll be talking about human sexuality again, this time as it relates to college students. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, February 9th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.